There's a Chinese proverb Stephen Covey quotes in his book, The Speed of Trust. My book, my sermon's not going to be on the speed of trust. I have long gone on, and part two of that sermon will probably never be given. But he says, the time to plant a tree, the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. The second best time is today. How many trees did we not plant 20 years ago that maybe we wish we would have? In our lives, the second best time is today. What's the best time to have come out of the world? Well, some of us could go back many more than 20 years ago. Some of us have grown up in the church, and it's a process of taking that into a personal conviction, but hopefully we're growing up out of the world. When's the best time to have already come out of the world? Well, when's the next best time? If we didn't do what needed to be done 20 years ago, the next best time is today. Still today. Alan Hirst gave a sermonette last week. I heard it finally Friday. Michelle brought home the disc for me, and I heard it Friday, yesterday, driving around on some visits, and had a chance to listen last Sabbath there to the sermonette and sermon. And Alan quoted from Revelation 18, and he was making one point, but as I'm listening to him, in my mind it imprinted something that was a little bit different manner. Verse number 15 talks about the fall of Babylon. And it says, the merchants of these things who became rich by her will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing. So this great system, Babylon the Great, is built up. There's a religious system in there, but there's a financial economic system as well. Built up, and it covers the earth. And they're wailing and weeping, saying, alas, alas, the great city that was clothed in fine linen, purple, scarlet, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. It says, in 1 hour, such great riches came to nothing. It's like a house of cards. And you build it carefully and slowly, and it actually takes shape and it rises. But all you have to do at the right moment in time is to take out one of the base cards, and the entire structure falls down. All of Babylon the Great is destroyed, it says, in 1 hour. The riches came to nothing. It's like spending your life building up your estate, and then something happens, and the house catches fire, the car goes off the cliff, the estate is destroyed. It just turned and fell and collapsed all at once. I've been wanting for a number of sermons to speak about the financial circumstances around the world and our impact, the impact on us as well today. Every week, there's so much happening internationally and within our country that every week I can take the previous week's articles and throw them in the trash, the articles that I've pulled from various news or websites, people send them to me, I read them in my own magazine. I can take the entire list, throw them in the trash, and then on Sunday, beginning the next week, I can start a new pile in case I need it for the sermon then. And each week I just throw it away because I don't actually end up going there. I'm going to go there just a little bit today because, I want to apply it to us. But because of what's going on around the world happening so fast, I can literally collect articles from this week, and I can use that to address, improve, and illustrate my point about the times that we live in and what is taking place. I want to read an article by George Soros. I want to read George Soros because nobody will accuse me of just picking conservative comments in regard to the economy. This was published January 22nd. Wow, what's that, yesterday? Okay, the worst market crisis in 60 years. George Soros is an incredibly rich man. He says the current financial crisis was precipitated by a bubble in the U.S. housing market. You have to know what the core of the crisis is. The core of the crisis is we inflated the market values of our properties here in the United States. We mortgaged and sold those to everybody to get everyone invested. Then those were sold and processed into international markets in addition to our own, so that literally banks around the world held their investments in market properties in one form or another of this nation. And then the bubble began to burst, and the properties were not worth what they were supposed to. The loans were not as honorable as they were supposed to be. The financing was not as straight as it should have been or open as it should have been. And the bank's assets began to depreciate around the world. It happened first here in the United States, and we sold our bad debt to everyone else. Do you think that's going to make them really happy with us? Do you think that's going to befriend us around this world in some way? Precipitated by a bubble in the U.S. housing market. In some ways, it resembles other crises that have occurred since the end of the Second World War at intervals from 4 to 10 years. However, there is a profound difference. The current crisis marks the end of an era of credit expansion based on the dollar as the international reserve currency. When I go to Nigeria, we can go on the street, there's a guy standing there with a handful of dollars, $100 bills, and a big bucket of Naira, and we can exchange it right there on the street. We could go anywhere pretty much around the world, and we could make the very same exchange. U.S. dollars have flooded the world. It has been the international reserve currency of choice. The periodic crises were part of a larger boom-bust process. The current crisis is the culmination of a super boom that has lasted more than 60 years, effectively going back to World War II. World War II bringing us out of the Depression, effectively. Although a recession in the developed world is now more or less inevitable, some would disagree. This is his opinion. I don't think he's too far off. China, India, and some of the oil-producing countries, read that, all of our enemies, and even those that are claiming to be friends, they finance our enemies, are in a very strong counter-trend. Wow, the United States is at risk, and China and the Middle East and the countries in some respects that hate us are going the other direction. Is that prophetic? I think it would be. So the current financial crisis is less likely to cause a global recession than a radical realignment of the global economy, which means our enemies will rise and we will decline. We are in the midst of an economic and social decline because of our sins in this nation. With a relative decline of the U.S. and the rise of China and other countries in the developing world, that process is in the midst of taking place. When you see the sovereign wealth funds of other nations that have been built up because we need to buy their oil, and they are now buying our companies, bailing out our banks, taking partial ownership of our equities, you are seeing a transfer of wealth on a scale that has never taken place in our modern times. Empires rise and fall. The United States is such an empire, and it is teetering and on very, very shaky ground. Commentary, the United Church of God, from our website, from When Wall Street Plays God, Everyone Gets Hurt, pulled it off of 2 days ago. Again, the stack on my desk, I'll take and throw it away. Tomorrow I'll start a new stack in case I need to use it next week. It's coming that fast. It says, after 9/11, Wall Street handlers of trillions of dollars in assets. Now, trillions of dollars. You know how much $1 trillion is? I don't either. John Gould sent me a memo months ago or a while back on how much $1 billion was. Okay, $1 billion. Let's see. 1 billion minutes ago, Jesus Christ was walking on the earth. 1 billion minutes ago, Jesus Christ was walking on the earth. That's a big number. $1 trillion is what, 1,000 billion? There's no way to even describe the scale of the economic circumstances that have taken place. Wall Street handlers of trillions of dollars in assets manipulated the reins of credit markets, inflated them, to lure millions of Americans to take on trillions in mortgage debt under the false promises of rising home values and easy repayment schemes. Schemes is a good word. Investment bankers repackaged and sold these to greedy investors for high returns. Thousands of executives rejoiced over the legal but outrageously unethical compensation for these massive transactions in fool's gold. Wall Street investment bankers, traders, specialists, and analysts, and their management executives took home over $25 billion Christmas and Christmas bonuses in 2006 alone. Bonuses. Because of all these transactions, they managed to sell to all these banks internationally for goods that were, frankly, unscrupulous in the way they had been presented. What was new was the gigantic scale of this foolishness. Banks, investors, and insurance companies, on the grandest scale the world over, bought the notion that Wall Street could change reality itself and rewrite the biblical principles behind prosperity or depression. Even watchdog agencies that rate debt were obscenely compromised, while U.S. political leaders turned a blind eye or bought into the scheme. The destruction of assets and wealth, millions in mortgages and other financial instruments, is wreaking havoc in the world's credit and finance structure. This isn't some polemic. This is the church's commentary on what is taking place right now around our shoulders. Credit markets are in serious recession all over the world. It is threatening meltdown within weeks. Why would they say something like that? Why, that could get people upset or disturbed or concerned. Brethren, do you see what is happening around us? Already, U.S. stock markets have erased $3 trillion in equity value. As of February 2008, there's a $2 trillion loss in home property values, with as much as $5 trillion more to come. By one measure of averaging, that would equal approximately $60,000 in asset value for every family of four in the United States has already been lost. We'll just pay up. We'll just kick it in the kitty and we'll be even. You understand the word bankruptcy? What happens when a nation becomes bankrupt? We understand when a business becomes bankrupt, it goes out of business. Does the nation go out of business? No, the nation goes into economic decline, serious economic decline, which is a loss of power. We have guns and bombs and battleships fighting against people that are fighting against us with toothpicks and straws. And they are holding their own in various degrees around this world in different ways. It's a dramatic time. Again, I've wanted to address some of this. I've hesitated to, because it would sound inflammatory that I'm trying to stir up that there's really trouble out there. But the church has done it for me by, I can quote what we have said in our own publications. I mentioned a few sermons back somewhere that the canary in the gold mine, excuse me, and that's exactly how I said it. It was wrong then, it's wrong now. The canary in the coal mine. Gold mine wasn't quite the same problem. Canary in the coal mine was the commodities prices and or the precious metals prices at that time. Does anybody have any idea what the price of platinum was 30 days ago? $1,550, 30 days. You know how much it's gone up in a month? It has gone up 39%. Boy, wouldn't you like to have a few bars of that? 1 month, 1/12th of a year, increase in the price of one of the precious metals, dramatically, 39%. You can say, well, you know, that's a shutdown. It's coming from South Africa. They're losing power to the mines. There's a breakdown in distribution, all of those things. There's an economic crisis as well, or it wouldn't have been $1,550 in the first place. This is for real. Now, if you think that's some kind of exception to what's going on, then go out and buy some corn, or go buy some wheat, or go buy some soybeans, because they are at multiples of the price levels they were just in literally as much as a year or two ago. Well, that's a farm employment program. We're happy for that. We have the Palouse fields in our own area here. We have our own farmers. There's farmers across the Midwest. Those farmers have taken great losses and suffered serious calamity for, in some cases, many years. All right. Then go fill up your tank of gas with a tank full of corn and see what the price of that is and the impact that has on the price of meat and the impact that has on the price of what it costs to go and buy something at the store. This is not just in any one place. David Walker is the head of the GAO. GAO is the, I had this written down, GAO, it's the Government Accountability Office. I've heard of the GAO, but I wasn't aware that there was any office that had the word accountability in it tied to our government. He's the Comptroller General of the United States. This is a nonpartisan position. He's in office for 15 years at a time. He doesn't answer to any one person. He stays where he is as the president comes and goes until his office is up. He reports to Congress on the economy, on the state of the economy, on the budget circumstances of the United States. He helps prepare the reports. He said financially to Congress, David Walker, Comptroller General of the United States, said financially, we're on a burning platform. I've seen a number of articles quoted from things he said, and what he says is absolutely true. He's honestly and openly letting Congress know that we're standing in the middle of a funeral pyre, so to speak, and it's on fire. Is anybody watching? Is anybody doing anything about it? Is anybody listening? Oh, it's Chicken Little. The sky is falling. Everything's going to be okay. Greg Check gave the sermon again, had a final chance, first chance to hear it yesterday. One Nation Under God, small g for God. I think if you didn't hear that, you need to go listen to it. It's on our archives. Everybody wasn't hooked up. Colville met. Terry Swaggedy was speaking. I think we played a tape down here. I'm not sure. I think we did. Okay. So you weren't hooked up here. Spoke last week. Go out and listen to his sermon. Listen to it a couple of times. It talks about how embedded our nation, our culture, and our people are into pagan doctrine and belief, and frankly, worship, and the damage and the implication that that has to us as a whole. He addressed as well some of the very specific things that we should be doing in a personal way in terms of obeying God, doing what He said, doing what God recorded for us in the Bible. And you know what? We don't have the luxury of saying, well, this house of cards isn't going to come down on me. I don't have to worry that there's Christ. Oh, He's down the road. There's the tribulation. That's down the road. There's time between now and that. There's time to slide this thing out in the back of our minds. The deadline of the crisis is not here. The deadline of the crisis could be tomorrow. Not the crisis going to come back tomorrow. But the house of cards we are in is teetering, and you know what? God may well decide that He has work to do in the church, that He's going to use us, and He'll keep this thing moving in some way. But the risk is absolute. This is not a joke. This is not just some kind of a extreme warning. This is for real. The head of our financial system, effectively in terms of accountability, has said, look, we're on fire. If you were in a house and the house is on fire, would you say, well, it hasn't burned the bedroom yet? Yeah, bedroom's okay. I'll be all right. At least I can worry about it when, you know, the fire is at the door. Well, risk-wise, fire's at the door. It's at the door. Life goes on. We plan to go on. We make our plans. We've thought before when there was a drought, this was the drought and it wasn't the drought. But what do you do when it is? And you said, well, the last one didn't count. It's very, very real. What was the best time to have put our lives in order? Was it 20 years ago? Well, what's the next best time? How about today? How about today? This life does not just go on forever. Luke 17 gives an analogy in this very specific tying in the end time with the time of Noah. Luke 17 and verse number 26. As it was in the days of Noah. Days implying a period of time during his life. How long was Noah building the ark? Well, I think it says 100 years. It was 100 years people watched him building the ark and didn't seem to be too concerned about the flood. And the people that were watching that boat go up when the door closed turned around and went, oops, there went the window. The window's gone. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will also be in the days of the Son of Man. Days, the period of time leading up to Christ's return, time when he's intervening on the earth. There's a process of time. It's not just the moment of his return, but the fact is the time comes when the door closes. When does the door close on the church? Well, part of the door closes when the tribulation begins, at least. Part of the door closes, most likely, even before that. Now, when Israel was in Egypt in captivity and the first plagues came through, they were in the midst of all of those plagues. So as Greg Check was saying, I think it was in Greg's sermon, but he said, you know what? Some of us will lose our houses. Some of us will lose our jobs. Some of us are going to have someone help us in some way, but we also need to be being responsible and help ourselves. We need to take seriously the circumstances and the conditions under which we live and those things that we face. They ate, verse 27, they drank, married wives, were given in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. They went to work, they went to play. Likewise also in the days of Lot. They ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted. It takes time to plant and to harvest and to sell and then to buy more. They built. There was a process of time. This indicates that there was a measure of warning. There was an example being set. There was some way that they should have known better. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, rained fire and brimstone from heaven, destroyed them all. Even so will be the day when the Son of Man is revealed. So it talks in a broader sense. It talks obviously about Christ's return, but it talks in a broader sense than that. There's a process of time. You know, certainly the church would see warning before anybody else. Sometimes we just don't get another chance. Sometimes the only chance we get is now. Exodus 12. Imagine being in Israel, in Egypt, in that day. Exodus 12. Verse number 21. Moses called all the elders of Israel and said to them, pick out, take lambs for yourselves according to your families. Kill the Passover lamb. Take a bunch of hyssop, dip it in the blood that's in the basin, strike the lintel and the two doorposts with the blood that's in the basin. None of you go out of your house until morning. For the Lord will pass through to strike the Egyptians. When he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and will not allow the destroyer to come into your homes to strike you. Verse 29, came to pass at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, who sat in his throne, to the firstborn of the captive, who was in the dungeon, all the firstborn of the livestock. When was the best time to put the blood on the lintel and on the doorposts of your house? Well, when you were first told to do so. Well, what happened if you didn't? Said, well, look, it's still bright out here today, you know, the night hasn't come, we're not in danger, and simply take your way, take your leisure, pass the time. Well, midnight came and it was too late. It was too late. You know what? They were supposed to go inside the house and remain inside. If you didn't put it on when you were supposed to, it was too late even then. And what would happen? Then you would lose your firstborn as well. Even if you were Israel, you would lose your firstborn too. Matthew 25. Different example. Yeah, that ought to shake us just a little bit. Because some of us have decades in the church. And we have decades of, I should have planted the tree then. Well, maybe we did. Okay, is it fruitful? Does it bear abundant fruit or not? Well, if it doesn't, then at what point should we have borne abundant fruit? Well, if it didn't get done, how about today? Because we don't know. We do not know at what point or if the system in which we live in the midst of is going to collapse on our heads. So we make our plans, we prepare our service. But brethren, we have to be ready now. We cannot get ready in the future. I'm warning all of us, I'm reminding myself, this is real. This is real. I think this is prophetic real. Matthew 25, verse number 6. Again, midnight was too late. I thought about, well, how important was midnight in Israel? Well, they went from sunset to sunset to a degree. I mean, the Sabbath had to be established. But midnight's something that you and I are using heavily. I wonder how much of the prophecy here is not really an implication for us today, even to the point where it's put into the way we would look at time. Midnight, a cry was heard, "Behold, the bridegroom's coming, go out and meet him." All the virgins rose, trimmed their lamps. The foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, our lamps are going out." The wise answered, "Say no, lest there not be enough for us. Go buy for yourselves." When they went to buy, the bridegroom came. Those who were ready went in to the wedding. The door was shut. The other virgins came, said, "Lord, open to us." And he said, "Nope, it's too late. It's over. You're done. You were virgins. You had your opportunity. You could have done so. You could have planted the tree. You were warned. You did not do so. It is over." There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Midnight, the deadline came, and it was too late. Anyone ever asked any of us a question, maybe in the Bible, because that's principally what I'm addressing in terms of this life or God's purpose or our calling, and we weren't able to answer it? Has anybody ever asked us something that we should have known, but we couldn't answer the question? Well, when will we be ready to do so? If we've been in the church 30, then shouldn't we have been ready 20 years ago? If we've been in the church 10, shouldn't we have been ready last, at least after 5? How long are we going to wait to be able to do that which God has called us to do? Sanctify the Lord God in your hearts. Always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason of the hope that is in you. Well, when will we do that? Can we do it today? In every single place, I'm just saying principally so as God has called us. When was the best time to have put into our heart the answers to those questions? Mark chapter 9 and verse number 25. The examples I'm taking from the Bible, because they come in line with the fact that I've used some of these examples in other sermons, I'm not giving the broader perspective and trying to show all the background. I'm just going to the kernel of each example for the point I'm trying to make. Here was a situation where a child was brought to the disciples to be healed for having a demon cast out. Disciples couldn't do it. Christ himself had to do it. He said, when Jesus saw, verse 25, Mark chapter 9, when Jesus saw the people came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit and said to him, "You deaf and dumb spirit, I command you, come out of him and enter him no more." The spirit cried out, convulsed him greatly, came out of him, and he became as one dead, so that many said, "He is dead." Jesus took him by the hand, lifted him up, and he arose. When he had come into the house, his disciples asked him privately, "Why could we not cast him out?" And he said, "This kind cannot come out except by prayer and fasting." By nothing but prayer and fasting. He said, "You weren't ready. The job came to you, the responsibility came to you, and you couldn't get it done. Because you hadn't prepared yourself and taken advantage of what power I had made available to you." You know, when do we get ready? And so the disciples probably said, "We'll be ready for the next one." Well, I hope the next one came, and I hope indeed that was carried out. But they didn't fulfill the responsibility they had been given the first time. When was the best time for the disciples to have strengthened their spiritual focus. Well, then, what's the next best time? How long can we wait? Last week, Greg talked about coming out of this world, the gods of this world. He talked about getting our finances in order. Mr. Armstrong talked about getting our finances in order. He's been dead for decades. Our young people have grown up in the church and don't even know who he was, hardly. It's been that long ago, and he warned us. But it didn't happen. We've had prosperity. The markets have exploded. Look what happened to our houses. You know, if you had a house, then the value of the house exploded. Oh, really? Well, that's some of the problem, because it's inflation and it's been spread around and cast into all the rest of the world in ways that has caused damage, frankly, to all. What's the best time to get our health in order? When do we get our health in order? When do we start watching what we eat and if we exercise and what we choose to do? And the restraint that is required sometimes in our lives in order to live our lives in a responsible manner. When do we choose between what is garbage and what is food? One of the postings on the forum from one of the men internationally said, you know, we've spent so much time worrying about clean and unclean. Obviously, we worry about clean and unclean. God said so. He said, but so much of what man has done is unclean, and we're sick because we have taken of it, but because there was no law against it, we went ahead and imbibed. We went ahead and took it in and didn't seem to care. He said, why don't we care anymore? Why don't we care? Greg talked about putting our lives in order in various ways. What's the best time to have started doing that? When's the best time to quit smoking? When's the best time to stop overeating? When's the best time to stop abusing alcohol? You know, when's the best time to have said you were sorry, or that I am sorry, or that my life is not in order where it could have been or should have been? It should have been 20 years ago. That's the best time, maybe. Well, what's the next best time? Well, how about today? How about today? You don't know the evil that comes tomorrow, neither you nor I. But even our own publication said, you know what? You could literally be within a few weeks of something collapsing around us financially. And if it doesn't, it will be because God has chosen to continue the work. It will not be because man deserves the time or what man has built is so valuable. It will simply be God's choice. Platinum up 39% in a month from astronomical levels is unbelievable. It is in response to very critical times. Look at Isaiah chapter 1. Talking to Fred Kellers this week, discussing some of these circumstances. He said, you know, I gave a sermon, and he went through and he laid out how this entire economy and circumstance of the United States could collapse in 30 days. And he went through and he said, well, you have an earthquake or here or two. He said, you cut a few of the gas lines. You don't have gas. You don't go out there and get them all fixed, you know. You have a drought in a few places. All of a sudden, you don't have the crop coming to harvest at that point. I remember when I couldn't get gas from a pump at a gas station because the satellite feed was out for a week or something. I remember that. Everything is just in time. All the products, the manufacturing, the businesses, somebody puts a bunch of beef on the market that's got a bunch of sick and dead animals in it, and the schools up in Spokane have hundreds of cases being hauled out to the dump. What happens if somebody does something to the food supply? And on, he said he just went through and he looked at some of the prophecies in the Bible, at least in possible circumstance, and then he laid out, he said, you know, you could shut down this nation in 30 days, and you could have other nations around the earth still prospering. He said, you know, just take a bomb and let it go in the harbor, or just have something blow up and destroy part of the infrastructure in some way. That, you know, it is amazing. The fact that it hasn't happened, and the fact that I hope it doesn't happen, but in that way, God says, I'm telling you, Israel is going to be accountable, and they're going to be punished for their sins. Because the God of America, one nation under God, is an idol. It is an idol. I was visiting in the hospital. Irene George had had her knee surgery done. She's been to the hospital 3 times for surgery. They've opened her up twice and found infection. They've had to close her back up. She has to go heal from the surgery and clean up the infection to go back in the next time. Third time, she finally went in and everything went well. Now she has to come off the medication and the stress of the surgery, but she'll be moving to rehab, and she was doing well, and a nurse came in. I began talking to the nurse. Nurse made a crack about the news that was on. I said, well, who are you for? Obama or Hillary? Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton? It was obvious by the comments she made about the news. She said, Barack Obama. And we talked a little bit. She said, who are you for? I said, you know, I'm not really for anybody, but I'm certainly against some. And the conversation went from there. We were into abortion, and we were into, you know, various topics and discussions, and she was saying, well, the abortion's not in the Bible. I said, it does say that if you kill somebody with something in your hand, and if you intended to do it, that's murder. It does say that. Well, she could remember that the Bible had said that, and she had never quite thought about that in terms of abortion, something in your hand, intentionally. But, you know, we talked a little bit, and then she left, and then I thought about it. I said, you know what? I might not want to be irritating Irene's nurse. Maybe that's not a good idea. But she came back, and we chatted a little bit more, and she stayed friendly, so I stayed until I thought that Irene was still in good hands. But you know, the world doesn't even see what's going on, what they're doing, and how it is playing out. It's so incredible. But it's not that they haven't been warned. You can say, well, we haven't reached everybody. Well, maybe we haven't. God says the creation itself ought to tell you some things. Who has to explain to you not to kill a baby? Who has to stop and say, don't kill babies? Oh, I didn't know not. I didn't know not to kill babies. They knew. They know. And we knew that God called us out of this world to be fruitful, to put Him first. We know that. We knew it years ago. When was the best time to have put that truly in place? Well, if not then, when's the next best time? Book of Isaiah chapter 1, verse 1. The vision of Isaiah, the son of Amos, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem, and it mentions various kings of Judah at that time when the vision was given to him. So, it's a vision and message by this statement that regards to Judah. Now, if you read all the book of Isaiah, you'll see there's more in there than just Judah. But the fact is, the entry to it at least opens in that way. Verse number 7, your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Strangers devour your land in your presence, and it is desolate, overthrown by strangers. Wow, I think that's happening to us. Seems like it's in the news every day. So the daughter of Zion is left as a booth in a vineyard, as a hut in a garden of cucumbers, as a besieged city. Unless the Lord of hosts had left us a very small remnant, we would have become like Sodom. We would have been made like Gomorrah. We're talking destruction on a major scale. So Isaiah is prophesying. He's speaking. And it's to, at least in the opening comments here, about Judah and Jerusalem. So Israel says, well, look at that. Isaiah, you know, you're talking about Judah and Jerusalem, and we're looking around and everything is okay. Who went into captivity during Isaiah's time? Israel. Not Judah. Israel. So he mentions Judah and Jerusalem. Israel can say, well, look at that. It's not going to happen to me. They're the ones who went into captivity first. What was the best time for Israel to have put their lives in order? Well, before they saw this coming, clearly. And yet, did they? They did not. So then Judah says, well, I saw your message. I heard your message, and you said it was about us, and look at us, we're just fine. Israel, those terrible neighbors of ours, you know, they went into captivity, and here we still stand. You know, nanner, 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 as that goes with the kids, you know. Can't affect me, can't catch me. All right, so Jeremiah comes along. Jeremiah chapter 1. Verse number 1. It's in here. Just have to find the first of the book. Words of Jeremiah, son Hilkiah, of the priest who were in Anathoth, in the land of Benjamin, to whom the word of the Lord came in the days of Josiah, the son of Ammon, king of Judah, in the 13th year of his reign. And he goes through and he mentions Josiah, the king of Judah, and the 11th year of Zedekiah, king of Judah, and he says, until the carrying away of Jerusalem captive in the fifth month. So Jeremiah comes along and he kind of says some of the same things that Isaiah said. And Israel could say, well, you know what? Isaiah said the very same thing. And nothing happened. And this time, Judah goes into captivity. Now, they all warned him. And they could have ignored the first warning, said, well, that didn't really happen to me. Everything looks fine. I still carry about my life and go about my business. Well, it was Israel that went into captivity first, but Judah certainly followed. What do you think was the best time to be listening to these guys? Do we think these prophecies only apply to those days back then? Well, what's the best time then to put into effect what we need to do on the basis of the warning they have given in our time today? When's the best time to do that? Revelation 22, verse number 6. These words are faithful and true. The Lord God of the holy prophets sent his angel to show his servants the things which must shortly take place. So the book of Revelation is a prophecy of the formation of the church, a message to the churches that carry on down through a couple of thousand years, you know, a billion minutes, since the time that Jesus Christ walked on the earth, and there are hundreds of billions of dollars that are going down into the toilet in very specific places, some in even one institution at a time. It is almost beyond belief. It's beyond what we can measure. But again, the warnings that are here in regard to the open door, in regard to being spiritually hot or cold or lukewarm, in regard to he who has ears, let him hear. Behold, I'm coming quickly. What's the best time to have believed in that? Blessed is he who keeps the words of the prophecy of this book. Verse number 10. He said to me, don't seal the words of the prophecy of this book. The time is at hand. The time is at hand. You know, the point comes someday when you look around and you say, you know what? It really is. It really is at hand. This is really the time. Boy, I should have done that yesterday. I guess I have to be ready now. But I thought I had time. I thought there was more option. I thought, well, I could fix it later. The time is at hand. He who is unjust, let him be unjust still. He who is filthy, let him be filthy still, because it's too late. It's too late. He who is righteous, let him be righteous still. He who is holy, let him be holy still, because he will indeed go on in that way. February 21st, off of our website, a lesson in priorities. You know, what are our priorities? Where do we keep our focus? Jesus explained that eternal life is a spiritual issue of paramount importance. The wealth of the man was not intrinsically wrong, but his misplaced priorities, his improper attachment to material wealth, was. Christ perceived it, I'm breaking into Mark chapter 10 in the story that is there. Christ perceived that the man was more interested in his money than God. Indeed, the young man was despondent over Christ's words, and he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. God has revealed in his word, the Bible, all essential knowledge that humans need to come into harmony with his ways in both spiritual and physical matters. God has given his people specific instructions for supporting the poor. Deuteronomy 14, Deuteronomy 15, Deuteronomy 26. His word even gives instructions on how people should provide financially for annual religious observances, Deuteronomy 12 and 14. You don't wait to the feast to set aside your second tithe in order to go to the feast. You set it aside as you receive increase. If you're having financial troubles, you pay your tithes to make sure that you are supporting and worshiping God according to His Word so that He will bless us and intercede on our behalf. The last place you want to be is on your own, fighting your own way. When's the best time to begin to obey God fully? Well, way back there sometime. When's the next best time? How about today? Jesus took the lesson of spiritual and financial priorities a step further. Peter began to say to him, "See, we've left all and followed you." So Jesus answered and said, "Well, assuredly I say to you, there is no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife, children or lands for my sake, not because we were foolish, not because we didn't keep our focus, not because he didn't do what he gave us, and the Gospels, who shall not receive 100-fold now in this time, houses, brothers and sisters, mothers and children, lands, with persecution at a price, and in the age to come, eternal life." Here Jesus promises physical and spiritual rewards for putting him first. For putting him first. Remember going over a sermon that I had given in San Antonio on the Dark Continent. And we're going to post that on the website. And was going through looking at evaluating the comments. And I was visiting there with Army buddies. And I've mentioned before that some of the Army buddies there actually had PTSD after Vietnam, post-traumatic stress disorder, and that they struggled with that through their life. And then I stop and I look at myself and go, okay, you know, I don't have that, but I had family. I came out of the Army into the church, and I had brothers and sisters. I had family and friends in a way that I had never known in my life. And I had it anywhere I went, anywhere I wanted to go. When we were in college and we were going to go up to Orr, Minnesota to go to the summer camp, we could call ahead to just the city on the way, say, "We're coming in from the college, we're headed to camp. Any chance to stay in somewhere?" We always had a place to stay, home. We had family, somebody to feed us a meal. When we were on the bike team, 1976, going coast to coast, 4,300 miles, we stayed with brethren all the way across the United States. We had 100 people traveling together. And in some areas where there weren't as many members, up in Wyoming, they actually formed and built a wagon with hot water heaters in it so we could take showers and chuck wagon. And they followed us along the way and cooked and helped us as we went through those areas. It was unbelievable. I have lived the majority of my life with more brothers and sisters, brethren, than I have ever had in any other circumstance, more than I would have ever imagined. I think it had an impact on what happened to me when I came out of the service and went back into this life. God has blessed us all. He's made available to us all blessings in remarkable ways. It's God's promise. It's His nurture and His care. But again, it goes back. Jesus promises spiritual and physical rewards for putting Him first. When's the best time to have done that? 20 years ago? Well, if not then, how about today?